Climate change is a particularly pressing problem in Antarctica, specifically West Antarctica, where the massive Thwaites Glacier has been called the world's most dangerous. The reason is that while its collapse would raise sea level around 65 centimetres, it could also trigger a wider collapse of ice, enough to raise sea level by 3.3 metres in a few hundred years, and Thwaites Glacier is shedding 35 billion tonnes of ice a year. Professor Terry Wilson is a pioneer of the first continental-scale network of GPS in Antarctica, started in 2007. And this provides information about the interaction of the solid Earth and the ice sheets. She's a professor emerita and senior research scientist at the Byrd Polar and Climate Research Center at Ohio State University. And she heads the Polar Earth Observing Network, or PolNet. Professor Wilson delivered the S.T. Lee Lecture at Victoria University's Antarctic Research Center on Thursday. And I asked her about the origins of the Antarctic GPS network.
GPS had previously been used in Antarctica primarily to measure the motion of the ice itself and how fast it was moving. But elsewhere in the world, in Fennoscandia, for example, Sweden, Norway, that was formerly covered with an ice sheet that's completely disappeared in the last 20,000 years, they were using GPS and very successfully measuring the pattern of motion. It's actually both uplift and subsidence that is the result of this rebound after the weight of the ice is removed. And we thought, okay, well, Antarctica, everything's harder to study because it's covered by the ice, but there is bedrock that sticks up as nunataks or along the coastlines, and we thought we should be able to do a similar kind of study. And in Antarctica, it's more valuable because so many of the geologic records of former positions of the coastline are covered by ice. So it's an important tool, and we decided we'd give it a go.
The uplift you talk about is the result of the ice sheet melting. Consequently, there is less pressing down on the Earth below, and the Earth below rises, in effect.
Yeah, that's right. One way you can think about it, which is a nice analog, although it isn't a complete match to how the Earth works, is a bathroom scale. And so if you add weight, you stand on your scale, and that would be the ice sheet. It goes downward immediately, and there's a spring in there that has a certain stiffness, and there's a dial. The GPS is like the dial. We're measuring how much and how fast it's moving, and if you step off, it will rebound back, and the GPS is measuring that motion. The difference in how the Earth works is that it's more like memory foam. You press down on it, and it takes a certain length of time to gradually relax and go back to its original shape. And again, that's measurable with GPS. And what we're trying to do is basically invert the motion to reconstruct how much weight of ice was lost.
Do we not know? Is there no other way of working out how much ice has been lost?
Well, yes. Our primary... when you talk about ancient ice, there's past fingerprints of how thick the ice was. You can see rings of sediment deposits, glacial erratics around nunataks higher up where the ice used to be that high, and it's melted and reduced its elevation. On the seafloor, there's a lot of fingerprints that the ice scraped over that surface and left its signature on the seafloor. And those are ways to map the former extent of thickness and spatial limits of, that the ice used to occupy. But in Antarctica, you also have so much of it covered by ice that those records are very sparse. So we use satellites. And the primary way we're looking at how fast and how much ice sheets are losing mass is by either satellite altimetry, where they use either radar or lasers to ping the surface repeatedly year in, year out. And as the surface lowers, the translation is to ice losing mass or melting. And there's another kind of satellite. It's called, has the acronym GRACE. It's the Gravity Recovery Experiment. And they have a clever system of two satellites that are pulled by the gravitational attraction of the Earth. So if there's more mass, a big ice sheet, then they're pulled more strongly. And there's two of them following each other in path, and one gets pulled first, and then later the second one gets pulled, and the distance between them is measured really accurately. And it gives a measure of the change in gravity, which is a function of the change in mass. So once again, year in, year out, they're orbiting, measuring over and over again, and they measure mass change. But so that's really, when you see maps of all of Antarctica and they show colors, here's where the ice sheet's losing, here's where the ice sheet's gaining, those come from those kinds of satellite measurements. The one of the key issues and one of the contributions of the science that my team is doing is that really, if you just measure the surface height change, for example, it's not just the ice that's moving. It's the bedrock underneath. It's rising up, too. So you have to subtract that off. You have to know how much the bedrock underneath the ice is moving to know how much the surface is due to melting versus just the Earth rising underneath it. So you need a correction. And it's the same with the gravitational measurements. It's not just the mass of the ice. When ice shrinks, there's less mass. That's right. And that's what you're trying to pull out of your measurements. But within the Earth, actually, as it deforms, within the solid Earth, there's actually flow of material in the layer of the Earth we call the mantle. And as the surface rises, mantle flows in. That's bringing dense mass towards the point where the ice is shrinking. And so you're measuring both of those signals together, what the solid Earth's doing and what the ice is doing. So we have to reconstruct what the solid Earth is doing, subtract that off to get what the ice is doing.
How long does that process take of the Earth rebounding?
Yeah, that's a super important question, actually. And it's kind of a science culturally interesting thing, because our views on the length of time originally is that this process took thousands of years. It was very, very slow. And that view came from the Northern Hemisphere, where geologically speaking, the ice sheets that grew at last glacial maximum were on old, stable parts of the continents that hadn't been deformed or heated up in billions of years. And so they responded very slowly. And what we found instead, and that's one of the big discoveries, actually, of our measurement program with GPS, is that Antarctica is completely different. It is a younger portion. West Antarctica specifically has been subjected to what we call rifting. That's where the continent is stretching and trying to pull apart. That brings the hot mantle closer to the surface. There's active volcanoes in Antarctica. So it's younger, weaker material, and it moves very fast. So one of the key discoveries that we made is in Antarctica, the Earth is rising up at a rate of 5 centimeters a year. Now, that sounds like a tiny number, but in most cases, it's millimeters a year of rise. And so this was a stunning and surprising number. And so what we find is that this process actually can work as fast as decades or centuries, not thousands of years. And suddenly that understanding from our measurements means that we have to change our thinking about how that motion of the solid Earth influences our measure of ice mass, and also how the ice sheet and the solid Earth interact with each other. It turns out that the bedrock underneath the ice sheet can actually change the behavior of the ice.
How?
Well, I know from previous interviews that you've had that you've discussed the situation in West Antarctica, what's called the marine ice sheet instability. And this arises from the fact that the land in West Antarctica is below sea level, and it slopes from the coastline inward towards the interior of the continent. And so the ice gets to the coast, it goes afloat, it's an ice shelf, and it's touching the ocean there. As the ocean warms, that makes the ice shelf and sheet more vulnerable at what's called the grounding line. That's where the ice goes from land to floating over the ocean. But because of that landward slope, it can become unstable and perhaps even thought to be unstoppable once it starts retreating down that slope. It's a self-accelerating process. So, on the other hand, what we've discovered through our measurements and a whole program of modeling that goes in parallel with it is if the land underneath is rising quickly, a couple things happen. That slope into the interior flattens out, and so the driving force for the ice to move towards the ocean slows down, and that stabilizes it. At the edges of the continent, at the grounding line, they're often on high points in the bedrock, so the surface of the earth underneath the ice is not smooth. It has topography, and so the high points, the ice hangs up on those high points. They're called pinning points, and they can hold the ice sheet in place there. So if we raise those pinning points by this process of rebound and the earth responding to the weight loss, then the ice sheet gets held in place instead of retreating rapidly down that slope. And the third effect really relates to gravity again. And it's kind of counterintuitive, but the physics says that the ice mass at the edge of an ice sheet the size of Antarctica's has its own gravitational attraction, and it's pulling the sea, the ocean, towards it. So sea level is high near the ice sheet because of that gravitational pull. So you can think about it like a magnet that's pulling the ocean towards it. As the ice sheet shrinks, that attraction decreases and sea level falls next to the ice sheet because it's not being pulled by that much mass anymore. That also slows down the ice sheet.
Right, because if the sea level falls, then there's less erosion, as it were, on the ice.
Yes, that's right. And the flux of ice across that grounding light gateway out into the ocean is slower if the sea level is lower where they touch. So all of these are stabilizing effects that have the potential to slow down retreat and slow down the rate at which the Antarctic ice sheet will contribute to sea level rise.
So if we look at the Thwaites Glacier specifically, it's estimated that it's shedding 35 billion tons of ice a year. Do you have any amendment to that measurement based on your work?
Well, it's not my work, but colleagues who are in the modeling community are, of course, actively looking at that problem. And at this point, they've done a lot of simulations. And if I could paint a graph, the simulations are looking at various kinds of time. It's kind of model time, but they can couple the ice sheet to the bedrock below. And that means that as the bedrock changes its shape and deforms and rises up in some places and pins the ice sheet responds. And so they do a simulation that lasts hundreds of years or thousands of years. And what they find is if they use an Earth model that's warm and weak and moving fast, that the amount of sea level contribution is much lower than it would be without that process going on rapidly from the response. And so these simulations, it depends. If you hold the climate scenario fixed, then you can significantly reduce by tens of centimeters or even meters the amount of sea level that is produced. However, you know, a key point to this, so, you know, that's good news,
yeah,
right? But the key point is that the climate is still really driving this. And the present trajectory of warming continues, we are going to lose that West Antarctic ice sheet. But the key part that's really important in translating our work and the modeling is that, well, it could slow it down. So we could mitigate, of course, our habits and reduce the CO2 trend. But, you know, aside from that, if we want to translate what we're learning into planning and policy for people concerned about coastal sea level rise, you really want to know the magnitude and you want to know the timing. And if it's going to be 100 years later, then that's significant for planning purposes. So we're really at the stage of the research right now of trying to reduce our uncertainty so we can translate it into numbers that have a plus or minus on them that is enough for people to translate into policy and planning.
I'm talking to Professor Emerita Terry Wilson, who heads the Polar Earth Observing Network and delivered the ST Lee Lecture at Victoria University's Antarctic Research Centre on Thursday. Some people might look at these findings that the stabilising effect is underway and regard it as a reason to take the foot off the pedal, a reduction of urgency.
Yes, that's quite true. And I have seen in the Twitter sphere, or whatever you want to call it, exactly those comments. And yes, my personal opinion, and of course we're still at an early stage of the modeling, is that the climate and the heat absorption by the ocean and the processes that we know that are destabilizing the ice sheet are the dominant ones. And what we're talking about in terms of stabilization effects, they're not unimportant, but they are certainly not going to override the dominant processes of warming, ocean warming and atmospheric warming. And so if we don't mitigate our CO2 trends and the warming that's taking place, these processes will not stop the loss of the ice sheet.
What do you make of, I mean, some of them sound completely wild, but various suggestions of geoengineering to try to ensure that at least the rate of ice melt is slowed down. Any of those appealing?
Well, I'm not an expert in geoengineering, but I'm also not frightened of geoengineering. It's not a different process than what we've essentially geoengineered with our CO2 emissions. So there's no reason we can't have a different kind of geoengineering that might help in reducing our CO2 levels. But there really isn't any particular thing that I am expert enough in to recommend or otherwise.
I mean, the suspicion is that we're just using another technological fix to fix a technological problem, which is
too much
fossil fuel use.
But isn't that one of humanity's strong points?
Yeah, well, that's right. It's an interesting philosophical discussion at best at the moment, really, because nothing's being done.
And it's certainly, you know, I think it's very worthwhile pursuing those and trying to think outside the square, as you would say here, about those kinds of mitigations. But fundamentally, I think it's really reducing CO2 contributions by actions that society needs to take.
When you say that the bedrock, the earth beneath the ice in Antarctica, is rising faster than anywhere else, why? Is that just a function of the amount of ice that's being lost? You mentioned, because it's young.
Yes, it's exactly those two things together. It's the massive amount of ice that's being lost so quickly, and the fact that that is happening on top of a solid Earth that's very weak and relatively warm, and so it's moving very quickly in response to that massive ice loss.
Because the other thing is that if the Earth is lifting, then that means that the sea level rise would be slower, not only there, but everywhere, wouldn't it?
Yeah, there's a couple little different things mixed in that statement. So, the stabilizing effects of not losing so much ice means that not so much ice is being contributed to global sea level.
Well, I was also thinking about the the less landmass that it's occupying the ocean space.
Yeah, there's a couple interesting things there, and I don't think this research has really been published yet, but if you imagine West Antarctica with those big, deep, below sea level areas underneath the ice sheet, and so ice is melting, they're becoming ocean basins, but the floor of those ocean basins are rising, and there's less and less land area, as you say, and that water gets expelled out into the global ocean, and actually that reconfiguration of the ocean is adding to global sea level.
You know, you said you're trying to reduce the uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, you're increasing the uncertainty, aren't you?
Well, that's funny because I gave a technical lecture at the Antarctic Research Center at Victoria, and a lot of people's comments is, boy, it's just getting more complicated and harder to solve.
Yes.
Well, I think that science typically has that progression. You know, we really made the first comprehensive measurements. We didn't know what was happening before we did. And now that we have observations about how the Earth is actually behaving, shoot, it's more complicated than our simple minds had come up with previously. And that's not really surprising.
Do you feel that the more we know, the less we know?
Well, yes, I think that we're identifying more unknown unknowns. We didn't really know. We should have paid attention to this before we got the information that we have. But, you know, again, I think that's the way science works, and I think it's a positive process. We can't ever really make a good prediction of how the Antarctic ice sheet's going to contribute to sea level if we don't continue to identify unknowns and try to solve them and quantify them and assign uncertainties to them.
The expression tipping point has been applied to climate change for obvious reasons, and maybe we're there and maybe we're not. What do you think, by the way?
Say that again, sorry?
The expression tipping point.
Ah, tipping points. Well, you know, tipping points are holy grail, obviously, because it gives us a target that we can design our policy around. I think there are some models that certainly strongly suggest that there are thresholds that we will exceed. But, you know, one of the points that I make in my technical lecture is, well, okay, but you're not going to get that tipping point right if you don't also include the effects of the solid Earth rising. That's part of the process. So, you know, it's very much an iterative problem that we have to keep solving each component of this complex interacting system to really identify a tipping point with any amount of accuracy.
I was actually going to use the expression tipping point in relation to scientific knowledge. I wondered whether you felt that, you know, the more we know, the less we know, and the more uncertainty, and then do we reach a point where we say, okay, we've sort of got this nailed now. That's the tipping point of scientific investigation turning into scientific knowledge.
Yes and no, I guess I'd say. I mean, certainly there's, you know, scientific revolutions. If you take, for example, continental drift and plate tectonics, it was, you know, became an accepted known fact that took many decades and a lot of data being acquired, and suddenly it was incontrovertible. We had so much evidence that we all accepted that that was true. And of course, we do get to those stages with enough data and research. But if it's good science, there's always new questions that are unveiled, these new unknowns that we hadn't thought about before. And so that frontier will always be moving forward with new questions.
When you started out your career, you did your degree in geology. Did you know that you were going to spend so much time in Antarctica? Was that your ambition?
Oh, my gosh, no. I grew up in Detroit, and it's kind of an interesting bit. I don't know how I turned out to be a person that was connected to remote places in wilderness, because I grew up in suburbia of a very large city. And I'd never heard of geology until I went to college, and it was a big discovery for me. And I was fascinated by plate tectonics. That was my first interest, and that's actually my training is in tectonics and, you know, things like mountain building, as in New Zealand. That's what I was studying. But I went to Ohio State. They have their big polar center there and started listening to people. And when I first went to Antarctica, it was to study the formation of the Transantarctic Mountains. And I was, my first visit was in 1989, and I already knew some New Zealand scientists then because they were studying the Transantarctic Mountains, and we communicated with it. And I gradually, when you work in Antarctica, because of the ice cover, you can't really study anything without getting involved in the science of ice.
Yeah.
So it gradually, I started the GPS project actually for tectonic reasons. I wanted to try and measure if the continent was trying to split apart. So if we had a situation like we do in North Island of New Zealand where it's stretching and rifting and volcanoes are associated with that. And it turned out that this glacial isostatic response, this rebound, is by far the dominant deformation process in Antarctica, not the tectonics. So off I went in that direction.
If we had, I mean, I don't know whether we do or not, if we had that kind of GPS system in New Zealand, would we not be able to predict earthquakes?
You do have a very robust network of GPS in New Zealand.
Obviously, we can't predict earthquakes with it,
yes,
then.
Yes, no, well, not really. I mean, the science of measuring the crustal deformation is definitely contributing to progress in the science of prediction. But what we can actually measure is the precursory phenomena. The bedrock of the Earth is straining and changing shape, and that keeps going until, boom, it breaks. That's your earthquake. And so we're measuring that precursory part, but we just don't know. Again,
when the
back
boom
to
comes.
Tipping point.
Yes.
where's the moment we could say, oh, one more bit, it's going to go, and we're just not there yet. Mm. But certainly the measurements that are being made of that type are super important in working towards a framework to predict earthquakes.
So what would you most like to know now about Antarctica that you don't know?
Well, my dream would be, just backing up for a second, our instruments, are trying to measure the bedrock motion. And so Antarctica, with its ice sheet, only allows us to do that where bedrock sticks up above the ice surface. And so we use what are called nunataks, which is an Inuit word for rock rising higher than the ice surrounding it. But where we really expect to have more rapid motion are areas that are covered by ice. So I would love to have technology developed that allowed us to attach sensors, bore down through the ice sheet, attach a sensor to the bedrock underneath that ice, and then have some kind of communication system to the surface of the ice that allowed us to measure what the rate of rise of the bedrock right underneath that ice sheet was.
And what's holding us back on doing that? The depth of the ice?
Well, you know, there's a whole lot of advance in what's called seafloor geodesy, where they put sensors actually on the seafloor and they monitor them from surface with communications and some kind of radio link. And in principle, you could do that under the ice, except the ice is very destructive and it's moving, scraping along the bottom. So how you would keep your instruments intact and measuring in that environment would be extremely challenging.
Right. Just let me ask one more stupid question. If we say, back to the Thwaites Glacier, if we say it's shedding 35 billion tons of ice a year, is that based on how much ice was there last year and how much ice is there this year? And does that include the possibility that the rock is poking up rather than the ice disappearing? Do you know what I mean?
I do. And the answer is kind of yes. It is repeat measurements. It's not really last year to this year, but it's on average over a window of, say, 20 years. And also you can break that down into pieces and look for acceleration. So the last couple of years were faster than the previous 10 years, and those are all from the satellite measurements. They do, when they make them, they have what they refer to as corrections for what the bedrock below is doing. But those corrections do not yet incorporate our measurements and how fast it's moving. Right. So they're making a correction in an attempt to get rid of that, but their correction is incorrect.
So essentially, Swaite's glacier might be losing less than 35 billion tons of ice a year.
Actually, it depends on the method that you're using to do your calculations. But if you take gravity, this repeat gravity measurement right. example, actually, the fact that rebound is happening faster and in the deep earth, in the mantle, there's material flowing in to replace the rising rock at the surface, that actually leads to underestimating the amount of ice loss.
Aha. Terry Wilson, she's Professor Emerita at the School of Earth Sciences at Ohio State University. She's seeing COVID out, at least for the time being, in Banks Peninsula.